I didn't prep for this again. Hello and welcome back to Let's Grow Girls, your favourite flowery podcast.
This week we are pleased to tell you that we've got another rose episode. We know how much you guys love roses, and we're welcoming back our favourite rose people from David Austin. Today we're actually joined by Liam, who is one of their senior rose consultants. Welcome to the podcast, Liam.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really pleased to be here.
We were just saying before we joined the podcast that I've actually met Liam in real life and I've not met Sarah in real life, so it's quite a surreal experience, but it's nice to have you here, Liam, after chatting to you about roses for such a long time. So we were really excited when we found out it was you that we'd be getting from David Austin this time.
That's very kind, thank you very much.
So before we get started with all the rose chat, Liam, we want to know a bit about you. How did you get into this? How did you end up working in the dream job with roses all day? Tell us.
Very oddly, really, I suppose. So I did a degree after sixth form college in French, German and Spanish, so modern European languages. And then when I came back home to Shropshire, I took the job at David Austin to work in the export department. So I was dealing with the French, German and Spanish customers there. Very unspecific knowledge that I had at the time, I suppose, about plants. I suppose it just started from there. That was 5 years ago now. There's a lot of information, obviously, that you can pick up about plants, and you can soon get quite addicted and quite stuck in.
Exactly.
And I'm very fortunate at David Austin to be surrounded by wealth of knowledge and people who just want to share. So from that time, really, I sort of came a bit geeky and obsessed, I suppose, with roses. And then...
Join the club.
Exactly. I know I'm in good company. From there on in, I, in recent times, have moved over to, with my colleague Richard, to the Professional Trade Services Department, where we both act as senior rose consultants and deal with garden designers and landscapers in the main, but also public spacing gardens. So we go to public facing gardens and give advice on roses and also carry out garden design for customers for their home garden with roses.
A sly question, but how often does that team hire?
not very often, but I'm sure we could make exceptions.
Well, I'm pretty sure the other day I saw some kind of marketing job over there, Sarah, so it could lean into your day job. And is Granny not around that area?
She is, but I mean, I was actually asking for you, Nicole. I could see you being a senior rose consultant. You're my senior rose consultant. I text you and I'm like, tell me which one to buy, please.
That's good to hear.
I could definitely help with the sales part of things, that's for sure. Enabling is my should be my number one job title, right?
Yeah, I'd definitely give you that job title anyway, just from seeing your pictures on Instagram. I think that's bad enough, you know, without the communication part.
I can't apologise, I take it as a compliment. Oh, so you kind of, I guess doing a degree like that with languages, as somebody who speaks like a second language myself, it's always a temptation to like end up in, I don't know, almost like teaching the language, right? Or in some kind of education role. And I suppose you're not too far away from education in what you're doing, but it's kind of funny how you end up using your languages and then coming away from it, isn't it?
I think so. Most of my friends from university probably or have ended up in jobs where they're using their language directly, maybe as a teacher or translator. I was really keen that that didn't happen. And it was coming back from university when I saw the job ad advertised and it said it was specifically about roses. I just completely scrolled past it and was just not really interested at all at that time. And it was only really having conversations with my grandma sort of saying, you know, just go and have a look and see how you get on, really. And the team, they were really fantastic at the time. It just stemmed from there. So I think you've just got to try these things, really, and see how they go. But it's quite easy to become obsessed with a group of plants. And I'm quite lucky because I only sort of specialise really in one group of plants. So when you're becoming an expert in something or trying to become an expert in something, having that focus of that one group of plants makes that a lot easier, really.
It's kind of opened you up to the world of gardening. I know you say you're focused on roses with the day job, but personally you've kind of developed the gardening bug as well, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be fair, I'm probably just like most people in that respect, that was really pushed to the extremes during COVID. And I think even looking back recently on social media, when photos pop up from that time, and I look at how the garden was then and look at how it is now, and social media has really helped with that. I know you were saying earlier about feeling connected to people through social media because you maybe see their pictures and you feel like you know them, and that is so true. And you also feel like you know what's going on in their garden. garden, what plants mm-hmm. they're growing, and their chickens in your case, you know, that kind of thing. You do get involved very much in that. So it's, you know, you only have to scroll past and you see somebody's sown another seed and you've added that to your list and then got 200 seeds that you need to sow, and just, you know, things like that really keep me going, I suppose.
My best example of that is I saw like a gardening hack when I first started in 2020 that said to write the year you bought your seeds on the back of the seed packet, because before you know it, you'll have loads of packets of seeds and you'll be like, when did I buy these?
Very
and
true.
Now I go through and 90% of my seeds were bought in 2020, clearly in the height of lockdown. I was like, mama's on a spending spree. I've got these like rare random varieties with 2020.
We're like, what else do we spend money on? Seeds.
Exactly.
Seeds and rose plants, because the collection definitely grew during that time.
Yeah, for most people it did, to be fair. We saw that in the company as a general rule, because obviously we were sending plants through post. I mean, it was such a busy time. I was working remotely from home. We were getting order after order and advice call after advice call. And it was great because people just wanted to call up and talk about roses and their garden. There were so many people getting into gardening at that time. It was a really exciting time to be involved with people who were just getting into plants, really.
Well, you talk about advice calls. What
this is like, I mean, the ultimate advice call.
A recorded advice call, essentially. We are here to discuss rose care.
Great.
So obviously we've just finished the time where we would prune.
Yep.
And most of us are starting to see our roses really leaf up. So we're hoping to interrogate you just like politely about your top tips for rose care.
Okay, so the pruning should be done by now. In most parts of the UK, we recommend that you do that pruning between Christmas and the end of February, essentially. By now, you should see the new foliage starting to emerge. Spring has really started to get going now, at least here in Shropshire. And so that new foliage, as it starts to emerge, is a good sign that the plant's really happy. So the next thing you would be considering doing is putting down a slow release granular feed, and you want to sprinkle that to the width of the canopy of the plant and lightly hoe that in. After that, and once you've watered that in, you can then put a layer of mulch on top of that. Generally, we recommend about 2 inches, 5 centimeters, which is really important, actually, particularly if you look at last summer, how warm it is. It's really important that you put that mulch down to help depress the weeds, but also keep the moisture in the soil and protect the soil a little bit. So those are the two things that are coming up really before you'd expect to see some blooms in the summer.
If we take a little step back to the pruning, obviously you recommend doing it in, you know, between Christmas and sort of the end of February.
Yes.
But we're recording this episode on the 24th of March, and obviously it won't go out today, so I'm not saying the date. If you haven't pruned them, like, should you prune them now? Is it worth going back and doing them? Or is it worth just like having a tidy up and making sure you've removed like the dead stems and that kind of thing, rather than going full on prune?
Absolutely, yeah. So I would take out the dead, dying, damaged and diseased if you can, still at any point really. But later on, sort of after March, by that point in most parts of the UK, the roses are likely to be in leaf. And if you're in a warmer place, so further down south or in London, by the end of February, early March, most roses can be in full leaf. And you want to avoid pruning at that point, because once they're in full leaf, if you start pruning then, you're kind of telling the plant then that it's not time to grow, and it becomes all confused. And the new growth that comes out is very spindly and more susceptible to frost. So there's generally two schools of thought. There's the idea that you should prune in that March time, which we don't do nowadays generally here at David Austin Roses. And then there's the other school of thought where you might prune in the autumn time. We don't really do that because most roses nowadays, the repeat flowering roses, which most of us have, are still flowering. So if you were to cut them back then, you're going to reduce the flowering time in any case. So you might give it a bit of a haircut in the autumn to avoid wind rot, but you'd certainly want to do your pruning when they're most dormant, which is generally sometime between Christmas and the end of February.
I like calling it a haircut. I'm going to use
a haircut. Yeah, I like that too.
I think
a little trim.
It's important, actually. So I did the pruning courses for the public in January and February with some of my colleagues. If you start mentioning the word prune in the autumn, people can get a little bit trigger happy and then sort of go really hard in on it, and you want to try and avoid that, really.
We might need to give a little trim at the moment, but we're not going to go full-on hard pruning. We're going to get feeding, right? Let's talk about feed, and you mentioned the slow release feed. I know David Austin Roses have just released a new slow release feed here in the UK. That's right, isn't it? It's a new one.
That's correct, yes. Yeah.
And what's the benefits of a slow release feed versus, like, you know, somebody just slapping a bit of seaweed feed in a watering can and putting that on? I mean, obviously any feed's going to be good, right? the slow release, what are the benefits of that?
So yeah, both of those feeds are absolutely good and great to use. The benefit of using a slow release feed is that it will break down over the course of the season. So if you take our new feed, for example, you actually, for repeat flowering shrub roses, you only have to apply that once a year. You don't have to reapply it. So you apply it end of March, start of April, you water it in to sort of prime it and start the reaction process of it breaking down. And then as the temperature increases, it breaks down over the course of the season. So that releases the nutrients as and when the plant needs it. Some feeds, there are other rose feeds on the market, some feeds you might have to apply again after the first flush to encourage the second flush. Something like a seaweed, a liquid feed, is absolutely really great and really beneficial and can be particularly useful when you've got roses in containers, for example. But they are essentially, you can think of those like tonics. When you water them in, the plant absorbs that really quite quickly. So if you are using liquid feeds, you have to use them with more regularity. So if you think of that more like sort of a tonic, really, and you think of your rose feed as sort of a well-balanced feed that breaks down over the course of the season, you might give it a tonic to give it a boost for 2-3 weeks during the season, but you should use your slow release feed as a base.
Anyone like me has still got like half a bag of the feed that they bought last year from David Austin. Am I going to need to reapply that then at some point during this season?
Yeah, if you've got the feed from last year, which is the organic base of sort of pellets, then you would need to apply that again after the first flush to encourage the second flush. But any new rose feed that's purchased, that's a once a year application.
Excellent. Going on to the next step about the mulching that you mentioned.
Yep.
Let's talk mulch. Mulch is something that I'm a bit like, what is mulch? What am I doing with it?
Okay.
I think I've seen in like the garden centre you can buy a bag of mulch now, but it's not the only thing you can use as mulch, is it?
No, and I think it's a very confusing thing, particularly for new people starting out in gardening and even established gardeners, because in the UK, the gardens that we visit, even some mulch really well, some don't mulch at all. We're not really as au fait with mulching as, say, you know, our sisters and brothers in the United States, where they mulch quite regularly and very well because they have fluctuating temperatures in the US. So what they're trying to do really is protect their soil. Mulch is not a specific product. It's a word, of course, just used to describe anything really that you use that's organic, can be inorganic, but an organic based mulch is anything that's used that you spread over the soil to help protect the soil, i.e. to stop it getting eroded in poor weather, to help suppress weeds and to keep the soil at a constant temperature, but also to help lock in some of the moisture in the soil. There are various things you can use for mulch. We use a product called Carr's Organic Soil Improver, which is a soil improver based on composted bark and manure. So you could use something like that or a soil improver from your local garden centre. You could also use well-rotted manure. That's one option. And get that again in bags.
It needs to be well-rotted though, right, for roses?
Yeah, I mean, for most plants, you want to look at it well-rotted. And a good indicator is when it doesn't smell anymore, to be honest. That's a good indicator that it's rotted enough, because what you don't want is it to be too fresh and to burn the roots. Generally, as a mulch in any case, if you're putting it on the soil, it's got to rot down and be broken down by microorganisms and taken in. It's not as worrying when you're using it as a mulch, but always strive to get a well-rotted manure if you can, if you're using that. But there are lots of other things. People often use bark, or you can use mineralized straw. That's another option if you prefer to do it that way. And then, of course, there are inorganic mulches, so things like aggregate, stones, that sort of thing that you could use. But generally, we recommend using the soil improver or the well-rotted manure, because it locks in that moisture and suppresses the weeds. But it also, as it breaks down, it improves the soil and helps with moisture retention as well.
So this might be a bit of a niche question, with me. Obviously, you know, I've got the chickens.
Yep.
I clean out their bedding once a week and they've got like straw in there, and obviously it's got some chicken poop. Can I say that word?
Yep.
Chicken poop on it. What would that be like for a mulch, do you think? I'm thinking in the essence of, you know, recycling waste. I mean, I tend to just, I've got a bit of a wooded area of the garden that I just dump it on, but then I keep thinking to myself, oh, could I be using that for something? Would that work as a mulch?
Yeah, so some people do use chicken manure as a mulch, but the only thing to be mindful of is whatever you use and whatever you do, of course, it should be done in moderation. But the thing to remind yourself of with the chicken manure is that it's quite high in nitrogen. And of course, the nitrogen is what encourages lots of leafy growth. What you don't want to do is be putting too much of that on, or the same with grass clippings. Sometimes people apply that as a mulch, or and that's quite high in nitrogen. You don't want too much of that. Too much of a good thing, obviously, it's not good for anybody.
And as well, straw, I've heard, I haven't tested this myself, but I remember when I did a deep dive learning about the no-dig methodology, a lot of gardeners have found that straw is like a haven for slugs.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Really? Do they like a slug? Oh.
Yeah, slugs like it, straw, and a few other pests as well, I think. Don't quote me on that.
Oh, no, we don't want more slugs, right? Although, I don't find the slugs bother the roses too much, but they might bother the other stuff.
No, I don't.
They can't climb past the thorns. Have you seen Gertrude Jekyll? Like, no slugs getting to a flower on that, baby.
No, exactly. They're not really interested in roses at all, to be fair. Slugs aren't a major pest of the rose group in the UK.
What a good segue.
That's quite a nice segue into our pest question.
Pests, great. My favourite topic.
Really?
Pests.
No.
Do you know, I've even started seeing the aphids on my roses. What are they doing on there now? It's still March.
Yeah, I suppose they're as confused as I am really with the weather in the UK. In that aphids, of course, that they are most attracted to young, sappy growth. To be honest, aphids are probably one of the worst pests that we have in roses. And if that's the worst pest that we have, when you compare it with things like Japanese beetle in the US, then we're doing quite well. They don't cause a great deal of damage to the roses in the main, but you've really got to hold your nerve for that first part of the season. And we're starting to see aphids a lot earlier than we would have historically in years gone by, because the winters are milder, so a lot of the overwintering eggs aren't dying off. And it also means, and because the springs are milder, growth is starting a lot earlier, so those aphids are coming out. The problem there is that all those good bugs, things like hoverflies, lacewings, ladybirds, they're not yet ready to come out. So you've just got to hold your nerve a little bit when you see these aphids. You know, it's easy for me to say, but it's really important to just bear in mind that some bugs in the garden, some pests are needed. If you take everything away, you're not getting a good sort of ecosystem in there, and you'll end up with just a monoculture. So you've got to have some aphids in the garden to encourage the good bugs in. So hold your nerve at the start of the season, pinch them off with your forefinger and thumb. You can blast them off with some water.
My favourite technique.
That's it. A drop of washing up liquid is the other one. But they're not too much of a problem in the main.
Yeah, I like to think they're ladybird food, so I don't want to totally massacre them. But at the same time, they're grossing me out at the moment. So I'm not obviously not spending that much time in the garden at the moment, or like at the allotment, because you don't know what the weather's doing at the moment, do you? So I'm just trying to walk on by, give them the side eye, and not bother about them too much. But
they're an interesting
they're
group,
gross,
really.
Aren't they?
They are, and not to sort of make matters worse, but they reproduce really quickly. That's the reason why they are in such numbers. And one aphid is born, it's already ready to give birth to another aphid and another aphid. So they produce really quickly. And
Sarah's face.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah, if you can, if you see on a rose, you'll often see that they're sort of all lined up right up to where the flower shoot is, really, where that lots of that concentrated sap is. And really, when you're taking them off, you want to sort of brush upwards and take them all off with one foul swoop, really, because they actually do release a pheromone, an oil essentially, that's released to let the other aphids know that they're under attack. So it's best.
Oh,
to do
my
it
gosh, they're calling for backup.
Yeah, they are essentially, yeah, but they're really something that we should just live with in the gardens, and not really a major pest to my mind to roses.
Yeah, I mean, they don't really do any damage, do they? They just look ugly.
That's it.
But there are other things that do damage, right?
There are, yeah, and I suppose one of the other major groups that we have in the UK is probably the sawfly groups.
Bane of my life last year, Liam. The bane of my life. They're so quick as well, aren't they? Next thing you know, you've got no leaves on your rose bushes anymore.
That's it. There's several groups, really. There's leaf rolling sawfly, which will roll the leaf up sort of inwards, essentially. Not a huge problem, but they roll them up really tight, almost like a very, very fine cigar, essentially. And sometimes if you open them up, you can find the bugs in there, but often by the time you've opened them up, they've gone. Essentially, it's just a little sawfly goes in there and it pierces the leaf, and the chemical that it releases causes that leaf to fold around it just to protect it like a cocoon, just so it can lay its eggs.
You know your sawflies.
I do know my sawfly, yeah. And I think one of the things with any of pests is you've just got to understand the life cycle of that pest so that you can then work out how best to deal with it. So there's that one, and then there's also the large rose sawfly, and then they can sort of, when they're an adult, they make those incisions on the stem. You'll often see like a cut in the stem, and and they often lay their eggs in there. So if you just run your nail down there and take the eggs out, and then at the larvae at that point, they're sort of green with black dots on. They can eat the tissue on the leaf. But again, these are all things that can just be manually removed and got rid of. And if you try and encourage a balanced ecosystem in the garden that bring in lots of good bugs, then you're going to reduce the bad bugs as well.
Because I try not to spray, really. I try to keep things as like organic as I possibly can. I mean, I admit I get the fairy liquid spray out every now and again, mm-hmm. just to kind of, if things are going a bit wild. I really don't like the chemical sprays and that kind of thing, but I think it's hard, isn't it? Because some people just automatically reach for them, but they're so harmful to other things, right? Like the bees and like you say, the other beneficial insects, like the ladybirds.
Yeah, so we obviously don't spray here at David Austin Roses now. And one of the things that we do in the garden setting is we use various methods of something called integrated pest management. And
when I was at David Austin. I saw those. It,
yeah. Yeah, people often ask us what those sort of little tea bags are hanging from the plants. And essentially all that's in there are the eggs of good bugs that are ready to come out and keep the numbers of the bad bugs down, essentially, if and when they are needed. So that's a form of integrated pest management, but it's very easy in your own garden to do that without reaching for chemicals. I, since I've grown roses, have never sprayed chemicals. To me, it's a drain on resource in terms of money, but also it's a drain on resource in terms of time. I don't really have the time or the capacity to be spraying plants all the time, so I haven't. But you can do that by making sure that you've got lots of other plants in the garden that will bring the beneficials in. I know nowadays there's lots of methods of purchasing, for example, ladybirds and bringing them into the garden, doing it that way. If you've not got lots of plants that want to keep them there, then they're just going to fly off. So if you plant lots of things with open flowers, things like cosmos and marigolds, and then other pollinator friendly plants like verbena and dahlias, of course, the open one, then they'll be bringing in lots of good bugs, which will help keep your numbers down without sort of having to resort to spraying if you can. But again, you have to accept some level of pest in the garden, and that's absolutely okay. And I'm giving all listeners now permission to have pest problems and have disease problems now and again in the garden, and it's really not the end of the world. Really isn't.
Next on the list is technically black spot, but first I want to ask a slightly tangenty question, because when you said the sentence, since I started growing roses, my immediate thought was, what was your first rose that you grew? I must know.
The first rose that I grew was Princess Anne. So it's a rich pink colour with a pompon type flower, probably one of the hardiest roses that you could ask for, really, in the UK. And if anybody wants a really reliable, healthy variety that flowers for a long period, then Princess Anne is one that I see in gardens up and down the country that are public facing, that does really well. Very sort of glossy foliage, quite thorny, but a very reliable variety. In fact, I still have the first flower. The first flower that I ever took off there, I still have that. It's a bit it's a bit worn now, but it's still there.
I love that.
Yeah, it was a real eye-opener for me, seeing the development of a plant like that, really, a bare root plant to flowering in that same year.
Would you say that she's hard to kill? Asking for a friend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, roses
are hard to kill, Sarah. You just need to learn not to leave the bare root next to the radiator before you're going to plant it. That was your number one.
Probably shouldn't admit that.
It's fine.
She is a bulletproof rose, definitely, if you want to put it in that category, yes.
I feel this is the year for me to try again. And I'm going to buy a potted one, because then no death for me.
Well, interestingly, you say that, but bare root roses shouldn't be overlooked in the respect that bare root roses can be planted from November up until the end of April, really. You've got a rose in a pot, of course. It's got a slightly more established root system. At this time of year, there'll be some foliage on it starting, but there's still plenty of time to plant bare root roses and for them to establish the root system and still flower this summer. And I think there's an automatic fear, particularly from people starting out with roses or new gardens, to using bare root plants. We are now conditioned, of course, to see roses in the garden centre, often in leaf or in flower, but roses being the traditional way to plant, there's still plenty of time to do that. And it's a very reliable way of planting your plants, because they establish that root system before the foliage starts then in the spring.
And they're much more economical price-wise.
They are more economical. They save on the cost, obviously, but also they save on the environmental cost of sending the potted plants as well. That's not to say that it's not a nice benefit of having a rose that's in full full leaf and in flower in the summer, because we've all been there when we've been in a garden centre and seen something in full flower and wanted to take it home.
It's time for try two. I can feel it brewing.
Maybe you should buy a bare root and buy a potted rose.
And see which dies first, like a race.
Which
well, I hope not. I hope neither. I hope neither.
It's not a threat. It's not intentional. I'd like them to live. Yeah, I might do that. I might buy both, actually. Okay, back to the topic. I'm sorry, that was a tangent. But I didn't
no problem.
No, we love a tangent.
So tell us about Black Spot.
Black Spot. Yeah, never heard of it. Never heard of it.
What do you mean? Never heard
of it. What? Doesn't exist.
Black Spot.
Yeah. If
you
only,
tell me.
Right, if only.
Black Spot. Yeah. Again, it's another one of those things that I've always found that people have worried about a lot more than they need to, really. And that's probably coming from having worked in the company and being told from the outset it's really not a big deal. Mm-hmm. In terms of black spot and dealing with it and causes, etc., the first thing to bear in mind is that making sure that you've done your research and you've got a good solid variety. You know, use the information that's available on the websites, catalogues, through people on social media, by contacting rose growers, and make sure you're finding the best and healthiest variety first of all. That's really quite key, because if you've got a variety every single year that is getting black spot, then it's probably not worth the space in your garden, with us spending more and more time outside nowadays. And the thing with gardeners, I've remarked really in the UK, is that we're very stalwart as gardeners in the UK, and we think nothing of having sort of a plant in the garden for 10 years that produces one flower a year because it was given to us by grandma 2 years ago for our birthday. But actually, if it's not producing abundant flowering and lots of fragrance, then it's not really worth the space in the garden. So consider if you've got a good variety first of all, and then obviously if you see any signs of black spot during the season, so you'll get those leaves that have black spots essentially with a feathered sort of edge to the black spot on it, and then often they're surrounded by yellow on the leaf, then you want to take those leaves off. So just pull them off and get rid of them. Put them in your green bin if you can, and get rid of them that way. Clear the ground as well. Don't let those leaves sit on the floor, because every time you water, then the spores can keep splashing back up. So that's the next thing, really. Keeping your plant in good health through various methods, so making sure they've been fed and watered and looked after in that way. But also, if you find that the plant is looking a little bit sickly, then you can use things like the liquid seaweed to give them a bit of a boost, perhaps as a foliar feed throughout the growing season. Now, while that doesn't act as a fungicide, it does help boost the plant, help it ward off. I suppose a bit like giving us vitamins, we're coming down with a cold maybe.
And like you say about the varieties, I know that's like one of the key things as a breeder, that the breeders at David Austin are trying to, like I say, eradicate. And you can't really ever get rid of these things, right? But
no.
You know, the newer roses are becoming much more disease resistant as a whole, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. David Austin Roses has always been extremely conscious of producing healthy, fragrant, floriferous roses that essentially mix together the charm of the old rose with the fragrance, but the repeat flowering ability and the colour range of the modern roses of the time, which was hybrid teas, but now the more modern varieties. But one thing that we're also keen to do with that, and caveated to that, is make sure that gardeners, the public, have access to the healthiest varieties. And that does mean in some instances that some of the older varieties that don't stand up to the modern health requirements of the newer varieties, they do get retired in place of new varieties that are fragrant and are healthy, so that people can remain engaged with roses and have a really successful experience.
So the other kind of disease that we had on the list, I don't suppose it's really a disease as such, more of a problem, but it's not something I've really experienced, and I don't know if it's more like for a different kind of climate, but do you find there are any issues like powdery mildew with roses?
Yeah, powdery mildew is certainly a disease that you do see in the UK. It's something that generally caused by one of three things. Either that it's a very young plant that's just establishing. Powdery mildew is one of the main causes is a lack of taking up of moisture, so not enough moisture at the roots. That's not necessarily to say that you haven't watered it enough, but if it's quite young and the plant's root system is quite immature, it's not able to take up all that water. So that's one cause generally. The second cause could be that you're not giving it enough water, and that's why that powdery mildew starts to form. So by increasing your watering, and it's better to focus on deep soakings every so often rather than little and often, because if you water little and often, the roots just sit at the top of the soil like fish in a fish tank waiting for food, really. And you want to sort of encourage the roots downwards and to search for their own moisture. Some varieties, of course, are more prone to things like powdery mildew, and so that's one thing to consider. Rambling roses, when they're establishing, they can show powdery mildew a little bit quicker, because what tends to happen is the root system's trying to establish, but at the same time they're sending out lots of really big and vigorous growth, and the root system isn't yet big enough to support all that. But again, you can counteract that really by making sure there's plenty of moisture in at the root level, and also if you've mulched on top, that will help maintain that too.
And so going back to the watering, that was the kind of the last thing that we had on the list for rose care.
Yeah,
last summer was hot here in the UK. I don't know what it was like over in Shropshire, but over here I think we actually saw like 40 degrees in Cambridgeshire.
Yes,
which, I mean, did you ever think that growing up in the UK we would see a temperature like that? Because I didn't.
No, it's a bit of a concern, really, in the grand scheme of things, because it means that we as growers are going to have to be conscious about what we're growing and how we manage that, also with collecting water and using it that way. Also, if you've got a lot of plants in pots, you need to be mindful about how you can keep them watered. Roses being shrubs, as a group generally, they are fairly good at, they'll survive if they're not getting access to too much water. But the thing to bear in mind, of course, is that they are flowering shrubs. There's very, very few shrubs that I can think of off the top of my head that are needed to flower from mid to end of June right up until the first frost. Most shrubs come and flower for 3 or 4 weeks and then have a big long rest throughout the rest of the summer. Roses have got to keep going, so that's why they need that feed over the course of that time. And also, of course, for that feed to break down, there's got to be moisture in the soil, and so you've got to keep up with that, really, particularly the second flush. I often hear people say that the second flush wasn't as strong as the first flush. That might be because when we start in the summer, we're all very good and very goodwill. We start, we're watering, we're giving the liquid feed, we're deadheading really rigorously.
We're not tired yet, is what you're saying. We're not over
absolutely
it yet. We're on our game.
And then sort of when September comes and that second flush, maybe we've not been out as much, but if you can just increase a little bit more water and make sure that they're deeper soakings, I'm sure you'll find that second flush is just as strong, because most of these roses repeat flower extremely well.
You're gonna say something, Sarah?
I thought you were gonna say something. That was fun, we just stared at each other.
I was, but then I thought, oh, I just asked the question, so I'll let you go.
We're moving on to a selfish question from me. Well, and actually, great. Nicole grows her roses in pots, but I am a new homeowner who's pretty much only got courtyards.
Okay.
So, you know, those roses that we mentioned that I'm going to buy and not kill?
Yep.
Those are going to have to live in pots. So what are your recommendations for growing roses in pots?
The most important thing, again, is making sure that you've chosen a rose that's suitable for growing in a container. And when I say suitable, I mean that it's not going to grow absolutely huge and not be able to be supported by the grow medium in the container. So shrub roses obviously are very good, but also consider the growth habit. Look in the catalogue, certainly our catalogue on our website, there'll be a little symbol that says that it's suitable for growing in pots and containers. Mm. Of course, really any shrub rose that is of a compact size can be grown in a container. But when you look at the growth habit as well, some of the growth habits aren't ideal for it. Take, for example, something that's really tall and upright like Queen of Sweden. That certainly can be grown in a container, but it won't be as bushy and rounded as something like Olivia Rose Austin, which will fill out the container a little bit more. So when you're looking in the descriptions, look for those buzzwords like rounded, arching, upright, and consider those. So look for the ones that are sort of rounded and bushy, or they've got that symbol next to them.
And not ones that say climbing or rambling.
Well, on the flip side, you certainly can grow smaller climbing and rambling roses in containers.
Oh, actually, I've got Bathsheba in a container, and it's taken a little while to get moving, but she's looking good this year.
Yeah, so in terms of climbing and rambling roses, we generally recommend that you look at the smaller ones that get to maybe 10, 12 feet in height and spread and not much bigger. Because anything bigger than that, and they need quite a lot of soil, a growing medium, to support that amount of growth. English climbing roses like Bathsheba, Claire Austin, Mary Delaney, Strawberry Hill, those type of roses grow really well in containers, but you just want to make sure that you've got a big enough container to support the root growth and development. For climbing roses, we recommend that it's about 2 foot or 60 centimetres deep and wide. And so make sure that they're big for that. For the shrub roses, It is a big pot. It is a big pot. But if you think of how wide the canopy is going to be of a climbing rose, then it's got to have a root system that's big enough to support that amount of growth. Of course, for a shrub rose, you don't need a pot that large. We generally recommend for shrubs about 18 inches or 45 centimeters deep and wide. And then put your shrub rose in there with a rose tree and shrub compost will do. Or you could use a peat-free multi-purpose with a peat-free Johnny's number three, say, and mix those together. Something a bit heavier than just multi-purpose, because of course you just use multi-purpose, the goodness can disappears really in about 6 to 8 weeks. You want something a bit heavier for a shrub.
And let's say hypothetically someone wanted a rose that could be in a pot but also be good for cutting, for cut flowers, hypothetically, what recommendations would you have for that situation? That's definitely not me.
Definitely not you. Okay.
No.
Well, I mean, the thing with the English roses and cutting, of course, is that they weren't bred with cutting in mind. So although they definitely can be used for informal sort of temporary arrangements in the table inside, the vase life and the stem length hasn't been bred with that in mind. So just be mindful of that. We have a really fantastic dedicated cut flower team who just deal with cut flowers for floristry and events. But if you were a home gardener and you wanted to look for roses, then I would probably consider things like Olivia Rose Austin. That's a really great soft powdery mid-pink, flowers for a very, very long time, repeat flowers well, starts flowering a little bit earlier most of the other varieties. So that's a really great one. There's also Desdemona, which is a strongly fragrant white, so I would consider that because it's got quite a bushy habit. And having, on the contrary to what I said, Queen of Sweden, you know, if you were growing it for cutting, then putting that in a container because you're just using it for the stems would be a great one to consider too.
And she actually, I think, holds up one of the best in terms of like the flower, like the petals staying on the flower. I think she's a pretty good one for that, and I love how straight she is. I mean, when you grow in like garden roses, you got to go with the natural sort of growth habit, right? Because they're not they don't look like, and I never buy roses from the supermarket, but they don't look like, you know, the pencil straight stem. You know, they've got a little bit of a wiggle in them, haven't they? But Queen of Sweden, I always think, is like super straight, the most like those commercial roses.
It definitely is, and to be honest, I think that's part of using garden roses. Part of the charm is that they are not perfect. That's what people are probably looking for. Queen of Sweden probably has more of a sort of hybrid tea like growth habit, more upright. The nice thing about Queen of Sweden to me, not only is it beautiful with its sort of pink and an apricot center, but comparatively to most of modern and English roses, it has fairly small flowers when you compare it to something like Princess Alexandra of Kent. So that's really quite nice to have a point of differentiation in a bouquet if you were cutting it.
Obviously, I've got Queen of Sweden, I've got a couple of those, but I'm glad to hear you mention Princess Alexandra of Kent, because I'm doing something that I know that's not 100% recommended, but I'm prepared to put in the effort for it this year. I have bought 3 Princess Alexandra of Kent, and I have planted them in a massive half whiskey barrel.
Okay, yeah.
I'm going to look after them all summer. I know they need the attention, but I cannot wait to see that thing in all its glory.
Yeah, I mean, that will make a really impressive display. And interestingly, you mentioned that, because if anybody comes to our gardens here in Albrighton in Shropshire, you'll see that we have quite a lot of very large containers in the patio container area with more than one shrub rose in a pot. As a general rule, in an 18 inch 45 centimeter pot, one shrub rose is absolutely fine and will fill out that space, because most of them get to about 3 feet in height and spread. But we grow 2 or 3 in a large container to get a very big effect quite quickly, because those roses are knit together to give you the illusion of one larger shrub. And that can be done, but as you've said, Nicole, that the really important thing is that you're just mindful that there's 3 shrubs in there competing for water and nutrients. So we're certainly able to do that on site at work, because they're irrigated.
Team of gardeners.
And we've got a team of gardeners, exactly, whose job it is to make sure they're looking absolutely fine. But in the main, if you've got an 18 inch pot, then one rose will give you that effect fairly quickly and still give you a substantial display.
And one last thing for your hypothetical question there, Sarah, about growing the roses in containers. One thing I discovered when I just started growing mine is I noticed a real difference, and Liam, I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but the type of pot you grow in. So I mentioned that whiskey barrel, which I think has got similar properties to what terracotta does. So they with the terracotta as opposed to like a plastic pot, you're gonna have a, it's gonna do different things to the soil. So if you put a rose in a black plastic pot, you're gonna need to look after it more because it's gonna heat up the soil more quickly, it's gonna need more water, etc.
Yep.
Whereas terracotta, which is why terracotta breaks when it freezes, it's porous.
Yep.
So it's more like breathable for the plant.
I thought it was the other way around. I thought terracotta needed more water because it
still needs water, but it's not like it's not heating up your roots. So I actually, hands up, killed a David Austin rose because I basically baked it to death in a black plastic pot.
Shame. Shame.
It was a sad time. It was a sad time.
We've all done it.
And henceforth, I have always put them in terracotta pots or my new whiskey barrel. Although I do have some in the black plastic pot still, but I watch those babies like a hawk. They get more water than the terracotta ones.
I think you might have just saved my next rose's life because I was just thinking to myself, oh, I've got a big empty black plastic pot in my garage. Just calling out. So I think you might have done a good charitable deed today.
Wow. See, I know you too well.
It's the colour, really. I mean, black tends to absorb the heat quite well. So black plastic, if it's in a very full sun, sort of south-facing position, will heat up quite quickly. Porous pots, obviously, like terracotta, they can dry out quite quickly because, as you say, it's breathable and the water's coming in and being absorbed in and out. So you'd just be mindful of that with containers. It's really hard. We get this question a lot. Well, how often should I water and with how much water? And that's so hard to quantify because it depends on the weather, the type of pot you've used, the soil type you've used, etc. The best thing you can do is really water it deeply when it's in a container. So a full watering can at least until the water's sort of draining out the bottom of the pot. That's a good measure of that. And if you're worried that it's too dry or too wet, then just put your finger about half a centimetre into the soil and check if it's still moist there, because sometimes the top of the soil looks really quite dry and dried out, but actually the bottom and lower down, it's quite moist. And again, if you've put your mulch on top, that will help conserve some moisture.
Well, I feel fully informed now as to what to do with these roses this summer. I'm going to invest in some of the slow release food, sorting out some mulch, not the chicken poop, and I'm good to go. And now Sarah just needs to get a move on with which one she's ordering.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's the checklist then we've got. We're going to feed them, we're going to mulch them, and some of us are going to buy them.
That's it. You've got plenty of time to buy them. Plenty of time.
And on the topic, Nicole, I believe we have some details about a discount code.
Do you want to share? We have a discount code coming, an exclusive discount code, which we'll be putting on our Instagram post when the episode goes live. So if you're listening to this episode, head on over to our Instagram and the code will be there ready and waiting. I believe it's only for UK and European listeners, though. So just be mindful of that, and all the other details will be on there too. So we're on to our last question of the episode, Sarah?
I think we are. Okay.
Your favourite question?
The big question. If you could give the people listening one piece of advice for the season, summer to come, what would that advice be? And it doesn't have to be rose specific, you know, it could be vague.
Yeah, okay. For me, it would be quite basic, but it would be make sure that you've chosen the right rose to grow in the right place. And I say that from a lot of experience in seeing 25-foot roses on 6-foot fences, 40-foot ramblers who've swallowed a fence and next door's fence and the one after, where we've been presented with things that need pruning or that are completely in that wrong space. So do your research, speak to other rose growers, look online, look in the catalogue, and just make sure that you're choosing the right plant for the space. There's a lot of information out there now. It will tell you whether it's suitable on our website for a 6-foot wall or for a fence or for an obelisk. Make sure that you're not just allured by the beautiful bloom. The classic example is Madame Alfred Carrier. It's a 25-foot climbing rose, which is beautiful, extremely fragrant. But you always see it on a 6-foot wall, and then people are constantly cutting it back and not getting many flowers because the plant wants to get to 25 feet and you're not letting it. So just to make sure it's the right plant for the right place.
Wise.
And if the listeners want to find out, like you said, head on over to the David Austin website. I know both the UK and the American website has got all of that information in there as to growing conditions, etc. And they can head on over there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Liam. We have loved chatting to you. And I'm looking forward to our super secret side episode that we're about to record with you, just to find out your absolute favourites. So if the listeners haven't yet signed up to being a Patreon, they need to head on over to our website to find out how, and then you can find out Liam's favourites too.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
It's outro time.
Thank you so much for listening and for your support. We are loving this season so far.
And we hope you are too. If you love the episode as much as we love doing it, then we would be so grateful if you left us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You can also subscribe, and you can find us on Instagram for more of our adventures at Let's Grow Girls Podcast.
We're really grateful having you here, listening to all of our interviews with our amazing guests, and we hope that you carry on enjoying the rest of the season.
See you next week. Bye.
Bye. You sounded really far away when you said that. You sat back.
Yeah, because I didn't want to shout at our people, you know.